now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Stuart Robson, Oliver Kay, and Mr. Matt Dickinson. We'll be discussing all the latest football action. Up next, we're going to have Manchester United and Liverpool from Old Trafford, Sunderland against Arsenal, and also a look at Big Sam Allardyce and the perception of British managers. One place to start, Old Trafford, Manchester United and Liverpool. A game with, I think, very serious implications. I mean, had United not taken the points, they would have been seven back or six back on Chelsea. And since 1999, I know they're slow starters, but they've never actually won the title when they've been that far back this early in the season. But of course, it's all a moot point because they are just 4 points back now. And from Sir Alex Ferguson's perspective, he came out, he spoke of the 3-2 result as a scoreline travesty. And he says they could have won by a cricket score, scoring 10 goals, which I guess wouldn't quite make it a cricket score, but in these days of 2020, but who's counting? Dicko, is Sir Alex on to something?
Well, I they were the better team. They deserved to win. But it's one of those things that those of us who've worked closely with Ferguson down the years, he actually tends to be more graceful in defeat than in victory. And I think this the last 24 hours showed that up. I think he was needlessly brutal about Liverpool. They left with some credit, quite why he wanted to rub their nose in it. Who knows? Because he's got issues with his own team. The defence continues to creak. Johnny Evans, I thought, got pushed around by Everton the previous week by Cahill. Wobbled again. O'Shea has his dubious moments, and to be honest, I don't see Man U winning either of the top prizes this season unless they deal with those issues pretty urgently.
Ollie, I thought Roy Hodgson was his buddy.
I expected him to patronise Roy Hodgson. Actually, I thought that he, in his eyes, he had a Liverpool manager who would be deferential and so on, and I thought he'd be patronising and say, "Oh, well done, Roy," and all this kind of thing. He was actually quite scathing of Liverpool's performance and particularly of Torres. And to be honest, I was very surprised that Hodgson didn't at least have a bite back or at least stand up for his player when Ferguson was accusing Torres of cheating. I mean, I can see Hodgson's his manner in post-match press conferences is to avoid controversy at any cost. But when your star player is being accused of cheating by the opposition manager, you would think you might at least stand up for him. I was slightly surprised by that.
Stuart, people talk about mind games and all the stuff and the back and forth between managers. I mean, you've been around managers. I mean, do they? Is this necessary? Does this mean anything? Do we in the media read too much, of comments that Sir Alex made just minutes after an emotional win? Or is he trying to send messages, and should Hodgson be somehow firing back?
Well, I don't think Hodgson should be firing back. I think that he did very well just to ignore it, because the only reason it works is if the other manager starts arguing back with you. And that's exactly what Arsene Wenger's done in the past with Sir Alex Ferguson. That's what Mourinho's done. Mourinho's had the better of Alex Ferguson at times. I never think Arsene Wenger gets the better of Ferguson, because Arsene Wenger never carries it through. But I think what Ferguson does, I think he knew that his team were by far the best side. And then when they got back to 2-0 Liverpool, he didn't feel that was a fair reflection on the game. And I think he just wanted to tell everybody that his team were far better than Liverpool, and Liverpool are going to struggle this season, which I think they are.
Well, from where I was sitting, I mean, I kind of agree with Sir Alex. I mean, in the sense that until Liverpool scored, got back into it with, let's face it, an acceleration into space from Torres, which and a penalty and a free kick, individual incidents. Liverpool had shown me very, very little. I thought they were really, really poor. Am I wrong, Dicko?
No, I'm not. It's to say that, you know, there's no doubt United deserve to win. I think, Tony Cascarino makes the point this morning, doesn't he, about the foolishness in his eyes of starting with one up, and clearly when Liverpool went to two strikers, they suddenly did look more offensive. But then, you know, I can understand the rationale for Hodgson's selection. Poor kickoff. Clearly, you're taking a risk when Torres still trying to recover confidence and proper fitness if you only use him effectively as a lone striker. But yeah, there was logic to that. United dominated, but you know, there's no great shock about that. Liverpool are really finding their feet under a new manager, and as Stuart says, it's going to be a long, hard road for them. But I mean, did anyone expect anything different?
Well, I got a question here, and anybody jump in and give me an answer on this one, because all summer long, it's been, you know, Joe Cole, he'll now be unleashed behind the striker and blah, 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 blah. And Gerrard needs to play in midfield, as if playing attacking midfield isn't really midfield. So what does he do? He plays Gerrard in that deeper position, which I think is wrong, fair enough. Mm-hmm. But then ahead of him, he puts Raul Meireles, who's not an attacking central midfielder. I understand he had Jovanovic on the bench. Couldn't he play Jovanovic and play Joe Cole behind the striker, as supposedly he was going to do all season long?
Well, I think everyone talked about Torres playing up front by himself. If you don't play with one up front, you're going to be outplayed in midfield. But what you need is your wide players and your midfield players to be able to support quickly. And Jovanovic was the ideal player because he plays almost in an inside left position. So he could have supported Torres when Liverpool had the ball. He could have then dropped back in to stop O'Shea trying to get forward, which isn't too much of a worry if O'Shea's getting forward, because he's not the key player for Manchester United's attacking play. But you need midfield players to go and join. You need midfield players that can pick out a pass. Gerrard does that when he plays behind the main striker. You know, every time Gerrard plays badly, everybody says he's playing in the wrong position. There must be a right position for Steven Gerrard, and he needs to be able to play in every position. You know, when he plays on the left-hand side for England, he should be good enough, because he doesn't actually play wide left. He comes in field and plays behind the main striker. It's exactly where everyone says he should play when he plays as the holding midfield player or a deeper player. Sometimes he's not disciplined enough, so he doesn't do his defensive work, but he can still get forward from that position and he can play behind the main striker. So I think they've got to find I think he's got to get the best out of Steven Gerrard, and people have got to stop talking about Steven Gerrard. He's not the be all and end all of Liverpool.
I thought Hodgson's 11 was actually the right one yesterday. I thought they set up in the right way, given that apparently his reservation about playing Morales further back, you know, in the Gerrard position, as it were, is that, you know, he's still getting to grips with the Premier League. Would it have been right to put Paulson and Morales in a midfield together, you know, in Morales' first start in the Premier League against Manchester United? I can see the logic there. I think the problem was really one of attitude and approach rather than personnel. I thought they never really showed the belief that they could take the game to United. I thought they showed very little by way of adventure, even when they had the ball. And I thought they defended. I thought they were comfortable as a half-time approach. But you know, there's a lack of quality, and I think there's a lack of belief as well.
Dimitar Berbatov scores a hat trick. I thought thoroughly outplayed Wayne Rooney and outshone everybody else. Stuart, the obvious narrative here is, okay, so they spent a lot of money for him, they've waited 2 years, and now this season, 6 goals in 5 games, he's finally coming good. Is that a little bit harsh on Berba?
Well, I think what he's now got is confidence. You know, whenever a player goes to a new club, they need to feel loved. I don't think Berbatov has ever felt loved. He didn't start his campaign at Manchester United particularly well, or his career at Manchester United particularly well. The crowd then sort of were indifferent towards him. The manager didn't play him every week. And once you start getting into that rut, you don't feel confident yourself. Now he's playing with confidence. When you're confident, you jump almost a foot higher. You run 2 yards quicker. You want to be involved more. When the ball comes, you're not thinking about miscontrol. You're thinking about where your next pass is, what you can do, creativity. What you can create out of the situation, and that's exactly what Berbatov is doing now. He can be a great player when he's full of confidence, and he's now full of confidence.
Dicko, do you buy this love argument? Because I kind of get the sense that the reason he's getting love now is because Wayne Rooney's having some issues off the pitch, and they've realized Michael Owen can contribute, and Kike Makeda is still a teenager.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, you know, he's. At the start of the season, maybe, you know, that maybe there's, you know, been discussion that he's going to be involved more, and he's risen to it. And you know, it's been a sort of virtuous circle at the moment, but a circle that might come to, you know, be broken if and when the United start playing games against the teams that, you know, Fergie traditionally goes 4-5-1 against. I mean, then he's, you know, if Rooney's back in good form, then there's going to be some hard selection, you know, decisions to be made. So that, you know, that's at the moment, you know, the Man U generally on a roll. Fergie's playing the two strikers, and everything is slotting nicely into place. But yeah, you know, say we're very used to him playing 4-5-1 against you know, the tough European games and the top Premiership sides, and that is when life will get interesting.
But could Rooney not play the position that he played for England in the last couple of games, where he plays much deeper and becomes a third midfield player?
Well, he could do, although, but you know, and obviously Fergie's played him wide in the sort of, you know, 4-5-1, 4-3-3, whatever you want to call it. But it, you know, it could be the case. But you know, Fergie traditionally has, you know, played three proper midfield players in there against the tough teams. But, you know, because he doesn't have a Roy Keane anymore, and you know, he's played Fletcher, Carrick, and Anderson, or you know, a combination of those sort of players. So whether he will drop Rooney deep enough and regard him as capable of doing that and holding, you know, bolstering the midfield. But you know, so I think at the moment he's on a pleasant roll and great, and it's good to see Berbatov, you know, showing those skills and scoring great goals like that. But you know, I don't think this is necessarily the narrative of the rest of the season.
Stuart, just about Berbatov's overhead kick, I'm assuming you either have scored goals like that or certainly come much more close to scoring goals like that than the rest of us have. I thought it was a nice goal, but then, you know, yesterday I spoke to a Spanish professional footballer who said that it looked good, but technically not actually the most difficult thing in the world to do, because the most difficult part was actually when he put it up for himself, and then the rest of it is body weight carrying him backwards. And it's just a question of getting it in the right general direction. Is that a bit harsh?
A little bit harsh. I mean, he's first of all, you've got to throw your body out of the way. That's the first thing. So you've got to get your foot high enough to get over the ball. And what he did, he didn't try and hit it too hard. So he just made a good connection. That's all he concentrated on, was making a good connection. And it was good enough and powerful enough to beat, and it was in the right position. But you don't aim for a corner or aim to hit the underside of the bar. You just aim it in a general direction and make sure your technique is good enough. And that's what Berbatov has got, good technique.
And finally, we wouldn't be talking about Liverpool without talking about our friend Tom Hicks and Perslow and RBS and picks and refinancing and all that good stuff. Bizarre weekend where first we had Hicks talking about buying, supposedly talking about buying out George Gillette's stake, now supposedly trying to get refinancing. Ollie, since you live closer to Anfield than any of us, can you maybe just tell us simply, is this good or bad for Liverpool fans?
I think if Hicks keeps hold of the club, it's extremely bad, because he's shown that he doesn't have the means, either financially or the emotional commitment to invest anything in the club. I mean, he wants to keep hold of it purely so that he can sell it at a higher price as he sees it later on. So, I mean, I think it will be awful for Liverpool if Hicks is able to keep hold of it. The board feel likewise. They want to block this at any cost. But what is not certain still is what would happen if he doesn't do it. You know, who would buy the club then? And our friends in China and Hong Kong are presumably still in the background. But I mean, this bid, which is, I mean, that bid, which is seen as the sort of most friendly, most constructive of the bids that's been around the last year or so. I mean, nobody really knows what they would do if they bought it. So, I mean, to me, it looks a really bleak situation for Liverpool.
Let's move on. Sunderland and Arsenal. I thought this was an interesting game because it was a 1-1 draw, and both goals rather fortuitous. But I think we learned something about Arsenal, did we not, Stuart?
What do you think, mate, you learned about Arsenal then?
What I learned about Arsenal is this, right? And guys, please back me up if you feel appropriate. We've been sold a line for years. Arsenal are soft. Arsenal don't have leadership. Arsenal are effete. Arsenal are camp. Arsenal without Cesc are nothing. So they're playing away from home. They take the lead with a lucky goal. Cesc goes off. There's no Robin Van Persie there. There's no Thomas Vermaelen there. The closest thing that, you know, the closest thing Arsenal have that approaching a leader. Alex Song, the supposed hard man, he gets himself sent off. And then they manage to hang in there until the very end. And in a game which You know, if we believe the stereotype, they were lost.
If Arsenal want to win the title, they shouldn't be just hanging in there against Sunderland, because I thought it was Arsenal's worst display for the first 60 minutes that I've seen for a little while. They were outplayed by Sunderland. They were second to the ball. They were outmuscled. They were outplayed by Sunderland. They hardly created a chance. The goal that they did score was a freak. And it was only when they went down to 10 men and suddenly Nasri and Rosicki started to take control of the game, that's when they played well. Koscielny did well when the ball was played in the box. But I felt, and I'm not sure what game Alan Shearer was watching at the weekend when I listened to his punditry, when he said that Arsenal were in complete control. Arsenal were never in control of this game. You always felt that Sunderland were going to score at some point. I thought it was Arsenal's worst display for 6 minutes. And I'm interested to see that Danielson, their midfield player, says, and this is a worry for me, Arsenal are the best team. If you look at Barcelona, we play just like them. He's forgetting one thing: Barcelona press the ball better than anybody else in world football. Arsenal still haven't got a defensive strategy when they haven't got the ball, and that's the problem that Arsene Wenger's going to face over the next few months. Has he got a defensive strategy that's going to stop the opposition scoring?
Dick, am I overplaying this whole sort of character and steel and we won't get pushed around argument the way Stuart seems to suggest?
I think a bit. Arsene's banging the same drum as you, isn't he? Saying, you know, we've learned, they are clearly a bit older. Some of them a little bit, you know, more developed mentally and physically and maybe tougher. But I'm with Stuart. I see the familiar scenario unfolding. I mean, clearly, the team is evolving with, you know, different signings with you know, Schumacher, with Wilshere being promoted. But I just see the same near miss, and as Stuart says, the same surrender of games that they shouldn't be because they don't have that defensive strategy that Stuart mentions.
Ollie,
they do seem to have a stronger will, if you like. If you look at the games, you look at the game at Liverpool where they forced that very late equaliser, which, although it was a fluke, it had come from 30 minutes of pressure on the Liverpool goal. If you look at the way they played for a portion of the game after losing Song on Saturday, I think they did show character, as you say. They didn't show an awful lot of the quality for which they're better known, but they did concede the goal, which is why we can't say, "Oh, Arsenal are suddenly something that they weren't before." That shows. I mean, that shows how sort of capricious it is, really. I mean, if Bent hadn't scored, if Clichy hadn't attempted that poor clearance, I mean, we would be talking differently. But that's football, isn't it?
Because what we're talking about is Arsenal winning the title, because they're an exceptional team. They're a great team. Wenger's done a great job on their creativity and flair and all those sort of things. But what's going to make the difference between them being a second or third or fourth team to winning the Premier League? And when you look at Chelsea, I can't see they've got too many weaknesses. When I look at Arsenal, you can still see they've got frailties and they still look vulnerable when things are going against them.
I do still wince a bit. I mean, I understand where Arsenal's coming from and have been a great supporter of him on many, many issues and many occasions, but when he still sort of talks with that slight air of sort of moral high horse about it, of sort of Arsenal being, you know, a superior force just because of the way they play the game, I sometimes just feel it gives his players, it's the wrong thing to be saying to his players. Instead of sort of getting them to just knuckle down and accept the bad breaks, they sort of, you know, get the sort of sense of, oh, the world's against us and it's not fair.
Well, I think the more he does that, the more teams will play on it. The more he moans about the physical side of people, the more they're going to do it.
Yeah, and the more his own players will, you know, sort of develop this sort of, you know, complex that the world's not fair, rather than just, you know, accepting it and getting on with it.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I want to stick up for Sunderland a little bit here, and not just because George Culkin told me to do so, but I look at the team they put out there, and okay, Lee Cattermole suspended, and maybe if he had been there, but compared to last year when you had Cattermole and Sana in the first half of the season, you know, running around, kicking everybody in sight, I thought they went out there to play football. Of course, it was a 4-5-1 system, and I mean, we can debate that. But you had Welbeck and El Mohammadi getting forward. Henderson can pass the ball. Riveros can pass the ball. Malbrán can pass the ball. I thought they went out there and they put on a decent display.
They outplayed Arsenal in midfield. Wilshere was caught on the ball time and time again, probably three or four times in dangerous situations. Song was caught on the ball. Malbrán looked an exceptional player in the first half, dribbling away from people. El Mohammadi won every ball in the air. That's why Sunderland had were able to keep the pressure on in Arsenal's half, because every goal kick, he must have won, and I'm not exaggerating, 15 headers. And
to be fair, he was jumping against Gael Clichy, who has a girl's name, and is a smurf.
They put Song out against El
Mohammadi.
Yeah, that's him. And he still won headers against him. They put the centre half out again. He still won headers against him. He was outstanding. He went past people. He got crosses in. I thought they looked a very good team for 60 minutes until Steve Bruce panicked a bit and started to make substitutions, and they lost their team shape then. And that's when Arsenal started to get back into the game. And their two players, Rosicky and Nasri, and Rosicky, apart from his penalty, has been excellent this season, started to try and control the match.
Final point here, because we love talking about Arsene Wenger and referees. Dicko, did he have any argument at the end of the game when he went and jumped up and down and remonstrated with the assistant referee and pointed over to his watch about the timing of the of Darren Bent's equaliser?
No, I didn't see it. I mean, the fact is that, you know, when...
Well, you didn't see it.
Like Arsene, I didn't see it. The fact is, you know, we just go round and round. When the amount of time signalled is the minimum that's going to be played, you know, I mean, there's only the referee's got his blinking watch. It's a cop out for managers. And to repeat my earlier point, it's I just hate the way that these sort of just become. I'm not saying it's not a story, but they've sort of become sort of raging controversies when we should tell some of these managers to get back in their box.
That's why we should introduce real time to football. No more time wasting, no more cheating, and no more injury time controversies. In the debate this week, we're going to talk a little bit of Big Sam, because it's amazing. I think it was Friday afternoon. Word comes through these quotes from Big Sam where he basically says that if he were managing a bigger club like Real Madrid or Inter Milan, he'd win the double or treble year after year. Now, I thought, like, oh, you know, there's that Twitter account. I think it's called The Big Sam. And I thought, like, oh, this must be coming from there. But it wasn't, and I went and I got Big Sam's quotes and I tried to see if he was being taken out of context or if he had been deliberately misquoted by the soft Southern press that he rails against, and no, he hadn't been. And he followed this up on Sunday in his mouthpiece rather, the News of the World, with where he has a big page, and he talked about he sort of tried to explain himself and said that, you know, he's seen as sort of antiquated and Neanderthal, and in reality he's quite sophisticated, and Arsene Wenger's not a very nice man, and so on. And I want to throw this out there to talk about the perceptions. I mean, I got the sense when I came to this country, as a foreigner, initially it did seem to me that, oh, look, you know, Arsene Wenger's the professor because he wears glasses and things like that. And there was this idea that foreign managers just more sophisticated and so on. I think that narrative has kind of gone a little bit. I mean, I don't think that people think Big Sam is necessarily unsophisticated because he's English, but maybe it's...
Well, I think Sam is a problem of the FA of 10, 15 years ago. The FA decided to almost go away from coaching, and we've got to get sports science involved more. You've got to be, you know, PowerPoint presentations. You've got to get people in the classroom and show exactly. Well, that's not tactics. That's not being sophisticated. That's gone too far. You know, you go around the academies, and it's why I don't think we're producing any really world-class players. And if you look down, I mean, I know there's a piece from Trevor Brooking in the Times today, but, you know, I disagree with that completely. I don't think we are producing world-class players. And the reason we're not producing world-class players is because too much time is spent doing in the academies, doing speed drills and sports science and psychology, and not enough coaching and tactical work on the training field, because we haven't got the coaches in this country. And Sam can hide away from his coaching ability by saying he's a sports scientist and he uses psychology as the main part of getting the best out of his players. That's only part of it. That should only be 10-15%. The rest of it should be your coaching and your tactical analysis and your technical quality, and Sam Allardyce hasn't got that.
Ollie, does Sam Allardyce spend all his time doing that, as Stuart seems to be implying, or does he actually, in your opinion, from what you see on the pitch, I mean, is he sophisticated? Does he have a sense of tactics? Is he even an archetype for the English manager? Because I'm not sure he is.
I think he's, I'm going to risk a backlash here. I think his tactics are sophisticated, but the football isn't. The football is, you know, what people call Neanderthal. It's long balls, often, you know, it's aggressive, it's getting in people's faces. It's the football that a lot of people, in particular Arsene Wenger, don't like to see. But it is very considered. He puts more thought into tactics, into set pieces, into different ways of playing to stop different players playing. And, you know, a lot of the time it's negative, but I don't think, if you look at Bolton under Allardyce, you look at Blackburn under Allardyce, and I'm going to discount Newcastle because he never really got his feet under the table there. They always look like a team that have done an awful lot of work on the training ground. Now, maybe that's his coaches, but that's the case with a lot of top managers that they do, they let their coaches do the coaching. Even the fairly unsavoury business the other day with El Hadj Diouf fouling Mark Shorter. Now, that is the epitome, really, of anti-football and all that kind of thing. But it did at least look like something that had been worked on the training ground. Now, if you call that cynical, then yes, of course it was, and nobody likes to see it. But there is a sophistication to that, even if it's highly cynical and highly ugly. It's he's a guy who puts a lot of thought in. A lot of his stuff is quite Machiavellian and underhand in some ways, but it's the kind of stuff that everyone was praising Jose Mourinho for when John Terry was blocking off defenders at set pieces for Chelsea. It's I'm not saying he's the, you know, Lancastrian equivalent of Mourinho, but he does have his strengths, and it's not just a guy who's obsessed with PowerPoint presentations. They work on things to come off on the field, and more often than not, they do.
Dicko.
Allardyce has proved himself very capable at getting sort of underdog teams to, as you said, Ollie, earlier, to get in faces. But, I mean, it is a whole different challenge to make your team sort of sophisticated attacking-wise and to play with that adventure. I mean, and even O'Neill and Moyes, I think, you know, if you're talking sort of British managers, should be way ahead of Sam if you're talking about being given opportunities among the big clubs. And even they would still have, you know, a decent amount to prove to show that they've got that that quality and that understanding of flair and enterprise and adventure. I'm not saying they're not capable of it, but they've still got it all to show.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap this up with a little game here, okay? Let's pretend that God comes down to Earth and decides to take Arsene Wenger, Sir Alex Ferguson, and Carlo Ancelotti away from their respective clubs and commissions each of you to suggest a British manager for those three clubs. Let's start with Dicko. Who do you see as a Manchester United manager?
who do I see? Well, I'd like to see Martin O'Neill given a chance, but
Arsenal.
Well, Bruce Rioch deserves another chance, surely. I mean, he's, you know, unfinished business. No, we're scratching. I mean, we don't produce good coaches.
Chelsea,
let's give Steve McLaren that one. It's time to bring him back and rehabilitate him.
Ollie.
People like Martin O'Neill and David Moyes, as Matt says, should be in a position to get those jobs at some stage, which I think is fair enough.
To be fair to Martin O'Neill, he was in the position to at least interview for the England job and then decided not to. And maybe his career might have taken a slightly different path. But
Steve McLaren was once interviewed for the Chelsea job.
There you go, Nugget. I was unfamiliar. When was this?
I think he had a chat with Kenyon. I'm trying to think. It must have been pre-Scolari, was it? Or pre... I mean, it was going
back.
Was
it for the manager's job or sort of kicking?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And originally there was, because there was thought of him coming in with Sven when that was kicking around. And then I'm pretty sure he had another chat with him. They've had so many vacancy periods. I'm trying to remember which one it was. But oddly enough, they didn't go with it.
This sounds extraordinary, because if it was post-Mourinho, then that would be sometime in his England tenure. And
have I just inadvertently revealed a bombshell news?
Breaking news. There's something about Dicko and England managers, isn't there? Stuart, you get the final word on this. It's interesting because the names that came up most often were David Moyes and Martin O'Neill, and you seemed to suggest earlier that if either one of those two guys were managing United, Arsenal, or Chelsea, those teams wouldn't be playing where they are now.
No, but I would go with David Moyes for one of the jobs, because I'd like to see him given a chance, because he hasn't been one of these managers that always complained about a lack of money. You know, he's done the best with the squad he's got. I didn't think they played any sort of creative football a couple of years. They were very much a long ball team. He has started to develop some technical players at Everton. They've started to change the game, albeit second bottom of the table. Glenn Hoddle, there's a name for you, because I think he's an excellent coach. He did wonderful things. He was innovative at Swindon. He was innovative at Chelsea. He didn't get it quite right for England, but I still think he's a much better coach than the people you're talking about, much better than Martin O'Neill, who when I went to Aston Villa first game of the season, I spoke to a couple of players. They were pleased to see the back of Martin O'Neill. They said his coaching was antiquated. And I'd go for Steve McLaren, because Steve McLaren was, until he got the England job, the best coach in England. I'd seen him work many, many times, and he really was a very good technical coach, and he could bring the best. He did a lot of work for Manchester United when they won the triple, and he's a good coach, but he just got it wrong for England, because he worried too much about the press and his own self-publicity. That's the thing he got wrong, not his coaching.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up by pointing out that not one person has mentioned Alex McLeish here, and also the fact that David Moyes, perhaps the most oft-mentioned names, I'm a big fan as well, is currently second bottom. Time now for what my producer, in a very silly way, keeps calling off the fence, even though it makes no sense whatsoever, and I like to call quick hits. Manchester City grabbed 3 points at Wigan, winning 2-0, but there are rumours of a bust-up between Roberto Mancini and Emmanuel Adebayor. Ollie, what more do you know? And can City compete without the big Togolese?
Well, I made the point on here a couple of weeks ago that obviously Adebayor had stayed with City after the transfer window closed. I made the point that if he wasn't going to be playing every week, I thought he would be as big a problem as Robinho or Craig Bellamy were perceived to be at the time. I don't think he's somebody who's great or good, at least if he's playing every week, if he's got his manager's confidence. But I think he's
Sorry for those who missed out. The bell has been replaced by this rather attractive and annoying duck call. So if you stray over the 25 seconds in your answer, then you get the duck. Chelsea crushed Blackpool to make it 5 wins in 5 in the Premier League with an absurd goal difference to boot. Stuart, how much does it matter that they haven't played any of the so-called big clubs yet?
Well, I still think Chelsea are the best team in the league, because the team that wins the league have to cope with anything the opposition throw. If they want to play a hard battle, Chelsea can battle with them. If they want to play a footballing game, Chelsea can outpass them. And they, whatever the opposition, when they press the ball, Chelsea can play around them. If they drop deep, Chelsea have enough movement to create chances. I think Chelsea will win the league this year, and without losing more than 2 games.
where were all those people who talked about how Ancelotti was rubbish because he'd only won one Serie A title? Spurs come from behind to defeat Wolves 3-1, but they need a sterling performance from one Alan Hutton to do it. Dicko, why can't Hutton get a game? And could he maybe be the right-footed version of Gareth Bale, a guy who gets ignored for months and suddenly becomes a world beater?
Why can't he get a game? Because going to Harry Redknapp, because his defensive work's not good enough. He switches off. He doesn't concentrate. I mean, part of his problem, he was 9 million, I think it was, from Rangers. He wasn't particularly keen to move in the first place either, so he was overpriced. Didn't settle great. Can he become the next Gareth Bale? I doubt it. And would he get more games? No. I think he'll still remain second or third choice.
25 seconds on the dot. That's why Matt Dickinson is a professional. Hate to pick on referees, but in fact I love it. But this weekend was a real stinker. And I won't even mention Lee Mason at Stoke, who was appalling for the few of us who actually watched that game. Ollie, who made the biggest blunder? Andre Mariner not noticing Marouane Fellaini doing a David Haye on Mike Williamson? Or was it Anthony Taylor who failed to spot El Hadji flattening Mark Schwarzer? Not once, but twice.
Well, as I said earlier, the Juve incident was fairly surreptitious. It was probably hard to see, at least the first time. He should have been looking out for it the second time, I think, after the Fulham players' protest. But to me, the one that Mariner missed at Goodison Park was just blatant. It was Fellaini turning around and clocking Mike Williamson, and he's a very lucky boy, and I wouldn't be surprised if the FA have a word retrospectively.
Okay, firing back, also 25 seconds on the dot. Very impressive, gentlemen. Robert Green's nightmare in goal continues for West Ham in their 1-1 draw at Stoke. Stuart, how does a player suddenly lose it so badly? And please don't say it's just confidence, because those of us who didn't play professional football don't understand that concept.
Somebody would say, and I would certainly say, you can't lose something you never had. I've never said that Robert Green was a good goalkeeper. I've seen him play many, many times for West Ham. I've been to Upton Park on numerous occasions, and every time I go, he makes at least one blunder. It might not always cost a goal, but I don't think he's a good goalkeeper. I said before the World Cup, he shouldn't even be in the England squad.
Okay, but he's nowhere near as bad as he is now, is he? One Match of the Day pundit said, and I quote, "We don't know much about him," unquote. But I have a feeling, Dicko, that you have a little more to say about Hatem Ben Arfa, who scored a stunning goal to help Newcastle defeat Everton. How much of an upgrade is he?
Well, he's been capped at every French level since schoolboy. That was Alan Shearer you were talking about, not knowing a lot. I mean, he should have known that. He should have known the fact that... Yeah, for Newcastle, certainly he should be a real force this season. He comes with a bit of baggage. He's caused a few ructions with teammates, but a good signing.
Well, I mean, to be fair, we probably can't blame Alan Shearer for not knowing much about Newcastle. Maybe he doesn't have much interest in them, or isn't really a fan, or doesn't read up about the new signings.
Gab, after a string of one-sided results in match day one, there are calls to revamp the Champions League and turn it back into a knockout competition. Having read your column today, I think I know where you stand, but please, since we all love the sound of your voice, why don't you tell us again?
Yeah, I'm debating whether I should read my column again out loud, because it's only 700 words or so. But no, in a nutshell, guys, the Champions League is not broke. There is no need to fix it. That would be the Europa League that needs revamping. Fact of the matter is, it's a great way to redistribute money to clubs in smaller countries, and interest is actually very high, even though some people in England might be bored with it. I think, generally speaking, the most deserving teams eventually win it. And I think, by and large, people forget that the past wasn't always great. That's all we've got time for today, but you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find news, you'll find gossip, you'll find analysis, you'll find our web chats. Mine is every Monday around 1 o'clock. That's UK time, of course. Ollie K does one too, which is very, very popular. You can also follow me and Ollie on Twitter, as well as many other Times writers, including Matt Dickinson and James Ducker and George Culkin, who I think is probably the most talented of the lot. But we also want to hear from you, so please, you can email us at gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk. That's gamepodcast@timesonline.co.uk. Till next week, bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.